Greetings to everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. Here's my first announcement. Please, cell phones, turn them off, as I hope mine is. Now, people sometimes ask why City Journal, over the last decade or so, has published so many stories about families, marriage, and child rearing. A policy magazine, the implication seems to be, ought to stick to matters like taxation, regulation, or, to get really far out, road pricing. But I can't imagine a policy magazine without such articles. The family is the fundamental building block of society. As political theorists since Plato have understood, the child is the father of the citizen, and how the younger generation gets raised determines the future character of a society. No one understands these matters better than Kay Heimowitz. Two earlier volumes of her City Journal stories on families and children have already appeared, Ready or Not and Liberation's Children. This newest volume, Marriage and Caste in America, is perhaps the most profound of them all. Over the last several decades, Kay argues, America has conducted a grand, if inadvertent, natural experiment in the importance of families. Beginning in the 1960s, Americans dove into the sexual revolution with gusto, sparking an epidemic of divorce and illegitimacy. But white Americans never abandoned the traditional family as completely as black Americans. And after their fling with sexual liberation, they came back to family life in much greater numbers than their black fellow citizens. Are two-parent families important? What do they achieve? As Kay will explain, a dispassionate look at black versus white life chances in the wake of these changes provides starkly clear answers tinged with tragedy. I expect that some reviewers resisting these truths will want to paint Kay as a prissy conservative killjoy, a relic, as such critics like to say, of the era of Ozzie and Harriet. They will have a mighty hard time making such a case, since nothing could be further from the truth. As a student at Brandeis in the 60s, Kay saw the cultural revolution of that era firsthand. And as a college English teacher, before she began writing for City Journal, she watched its further developments from a ringside seat, so to speak. Like so many City Journal writers, she started out on the left and moved rightward through the experience of raising children, that great instructor of psychological and social reality. But she never lost her iconoclasm and irreverence. Reading Kay is sheer exhilaration. Surely, there is no funnier writer anywhere about such weighty and serious topics. And how many social policy writers could produce, as Kay did in our current issue, an hilariously wise article about Paris Hilton? Let me blow City Journal's horn for a sentence or two. Marriage and Caste is the 14th City Journal book. I can think of no better proof that our articles are not ephemeral, but definitive. Book number 15 will appear this spring, and we already have at least three more in the works. I'm proud of them all. But none more than Marriage and Caste in America. And it's my pleasure to introduce Kay Heimowitz.
Well, thank you, Myron. That's hot. That's an inside joke. I wanted to thank a few people and welcome a few people before I start. My father, who braved the rigors of Amtrak to get here, thank you very much, Dad, for being here. I really want to thank Michael Barrero, Donna Thompson, and Taisha Camacho for putting together this wonderful lunch. It's nice to be able to give a dinner party or lunch party without having to do any of the cooking or planning. And I especially want to thank Clarice Smith, who has just been the perfect nanny for my book, and she's just worked so hard. Thank you, wherever you are. It's here at the moment. And then, of course, I want to talk about Myron briefly, because many of you know that this talk comes at a rather poignant moment for us at City Journal, as Myron moves on, although I hope not very far. I have found in the 10 years or more, is it, that we've been, 12 years we've been working together. Writing can be kind of a lonely and existentially absurd process. You know, there's the empty room and the blank screen, and you know, it's like the Munch picture with the scream. That's what you feel like. And then there's the suspicion that much of what you're writing is likely to irritate a lot of people you've never even met, not to mention your family and friends. But Myron's enthusiasm, his confidence, and his curiosity, his attention to detail, has really transformed this absurdity or ridiculousness into something, if not sublime, then at least personally significant to me. I truly believe he has made me a much better writer, and I thank him so much. The best way that I know to honor my editor and friend is to start my talk today with a Myron-like hammer of a thesis. So here we go. We've been having the wrong conversation about marriage in this country. While we've been debating about whether and how to renovate marriage, we've been ignoring that that institution is not only old, but actually quite sick. It is sick in a way that threatens our most basic values in this country. We've been a little like doctors standing above a patient, squabbling about what unit to take him to without bothering to diagnose the disease. What I'm going to try to do with you today is to diagnose that disease by reciting a number of key facts. Most of you have probably heard most of these facts before, but I want to bring them into a little more clarity. Half, actually the number is probably closer to 40%, of all marriages end in divorce. A third of all children are born to mothers who are not married. Actually, those numbers have just been updated to about 37%. And it looks likely to me, if you look at the trajectory, that in the next 4 or 5 years we'll see at least 40%. And there's been a threefold increase in the proportion of children growing up in single-parent families over the last decades, 4 decades. Now, all of this has been widely reported. You've all heard it any number of times. And all of it is true. But it's misleading. In recent years, researchers have begun to disaggregate these numbers by income and education, and a very different or a very special picture emerges from that. You look at these nifty little charts that we have handed out at your seats. I don't know who did these, but I should have thanked him too. What you'll see is a clearer picture of what's happened. Now look at the first one, less education means more illegitimacy. This chart separates the population of never married mothers by education. Now if you look, you notice that around 1950, there was not much difference in the way high school and college educated women went about the whole marriage and baby business. First you got married, then you had your children. By 1960, you begin to see a shift as these numbers begin to go up, but as they continue to do today. But what's striking is how different the trajectories of college-educated women are from the trajectories of women with less than a college education. Here's what most people don't realize. College-educated women never went in for the Murphy Brown thing. That was kind of a myth created by Hollywood. The number of college educated, or the percentage of college educated women who had children out of wedlock never rose much beyond 4%. Women without a high school education present us with an entirely different story. their numbers soared. Now, if you look at the next chart, divorces and separation, you'll see a similar divergence in trends. Around 1960, Americans fell in love with divorce. Women of every education and income level began divorcing. But by 1980, the divorce rate among college-educated women began to taper off. This was not the case with their less educated sisters. Though the rise slowed in the 1990s, their divorce rate continues to be about twice as high. Now, the upshot of all this is what I call the marriage gap. By 2000, only 10% of mothers with a college degree or more were living without husbands. And I seem to be related or friends with a good many of them. That's versus 36% of those without a college degree. The people who are the source for these charts that we just looked at, David Elwood and Christopher Jenks from Harvard, and who wrote the article that on which I base a lot of this first analysis, the article's entitled The Uneven Spread of Single-Parent Families, conclude this way. The rise in single-parent families is concentrated among blacks and the less educated. It hardly occurred at all among women with a college degree. Now, this would all be a curious, though not highly consequential demographic fact, except for one thing. Children who grow up in single-parent homes don't do as well as children who grow up with their married parents. For one thing, they're much more likely to be poor, 6 times more likely. If you look at chart number 3, you'll see some of what I'm talking about there. 92% of children whose families make over $75,000 are living with their two parents. And on the other hand, only 20% of children living with parents who are making under, or mothers, or excuse me, with parents making under $15,000 are living with both parents. It's not just poverty that's at stake here, though. If you control for education, for income, for race, for the number of siblings, children from single-parent families, both as a result of divorce and non-marriage, are more prone to just about every social problem in the book. School failure, delinquency, crime, early pregnancy, emotional difficulties, and so on. At this point, the evidence that family structure is perhaps the greatest risk factor for children is so powerful that, as James Q. Wilson has joked, even sociologists believe it. Researchers have found that single mothers tend to be less child-centered, their children watch more TV, the mothers don't tend to oversee homework as much as married mothers, and so forth. Another interesting little fact, the children of single mothers are less likely to go to college, and when they do, they are less likely to go to selective colleges. There is a professor at Cornell who some years ago looked around her classes and was kind of surprised to see that only about 10% of her students came from divorced parents, homes with divorced parents. And she was puzzled because, of course, we all hear the divorce rates are 40-50%. So she got together with a colleague, and they went and they looked at all of the, or not all, but a number of selective colleges, and what they found was precisely what she noticed in her class. That is, about 10% of the children, of the students at these highly selective colleges are the products of divorce. Children who did not grow up with their two biological parents were half as likely to go to a selective college. As adults, they earned less, they had lower occupational status, and here's the clincher that leads me to my title. They are also more likely to become single parents themselves. And as I say, that's the meaning of marriage and caste. We're becoming a nation of separate and unequal families that threatens to last into the foreseeable future. On the one hand, you have women who go to college, they make more money, they get married, they raise their children within marriage, they're not likely to get divorced. Those children are, in turn, more likely to be well-adjusted, to do well in school, to go to college, to marry, and only then have children. On the other hand, we have low-income women raising children alone who are more likely to drop out of school, or if they do make it to college, to go to a less elite college, and those children are also more likely to remain low-income and to become single parents themselves. Marriage, I think you can argue, when you look at the numbers, now poses an even larger social divide than race. As I've said, we've been having the wrong conversation about marriage. Now, I try to look at two questions about the marriage gap in my book, and I'm going to touch on them briefly in the time that's remaining to me. First, why does marriage make such a profound difference in children's lives? And second, how did we fall into the marriage gap? Now, the most commonsensical answer to the first question, why does marriage make such a difference to children, is what I call the strength in numbers thesis. That thesis goes like this. Married couples have two incomes, two sets of hands and eyes, two brains to problem solve when Johnny has locked his little brother in the bathroom with the tub running. But the problem is that children from step families don't look a whole lot better than those from single mother households. Those kids are not as likely to be poor, but they have more problems at school, with drugs, with early sexual activity, with going to an elite college, and so forth. Okay, so those kids have suffered through a divorce. Maybe that explains the problem. But then how do we explain this inconvenient fact? Children living with cohabiting parents also enjoy few of the benefits of those living with intact families, in intact families. Now, this strength in numbers thesis epitomizes a major reason that we've been having the wrong conversation about marriage. Americans in particular tend to think of marriage as primarily a relationship between two adults. Those two adults decide to make public their love and their commitment in a ceremony that these days makes Marie Antoinette look like Rosie the Riveter. The impact of the breakdown of marriage on children and on the rest of society proves that it is a great deal more than a simple relationship between two adults. It is what academics like to call a social institution, but what I've begun to think of as a little like software for the human brain. It gives people, marriage, the institution, gives people megabytes of necessary information about how to live. And let me explain what I mean. We know that marriage exists in every known human society. It is a human universal. And as a human universal, it defines the rights and responsibilities of parenthood. But in addition, marriage has specific cultural meanings arising out of local history, economy, religion, and ideals. American marriage is no exception. It programs people to organize their lives according to a middle-class script that will allow people to succeed in American society. That script looks familiar probably to everybody in this room. Childhood, adolescence, and early adulthood training for work, that is schooling, at least through high school these days it's essential. Marriage, and only then, children. That's the life script that the marriage program gives us. But the American marriage program also carries with it a set of ideals and beliefs that indirectly but profoundly help promote our national identity. It promotes the idea that children need a great deal of nurturing, that parents need to devote themselves to the children's social and emotional and cognitive development. This is what I call the mission. It also programs the idea that people raise their children in a home which they will work two or three jobs in order to try to purchase. It's worth noting that, since we're talking about poverty and inequality in the relation to marriage, that Western marriage, and particularly Anglo-American marriage, has long been tied up with private property and the accumulation of wealth. Interestingly enough, there's a recent study from an Ohio State economist comparing married couples versus singles and divorced couple and divorced people. The average net wealth of married couples increases 16% a year, and after 15 years, their net worth is 93% higher than singles or divorced. There's historically, I'll just take a brief digression if I can. There's a reason for this. The way that marriage was set up in this country, in the Western world, particularly in the English, in England, starting in around the 14th, 15th century, a man had to have his own property before he could get married. That delayed marriage, which was useful for not having too many kids to take care of and do the mission on, but also it promoted more accumulation of property. And I think you still see that orientation and that sort of message from the marriage program today. Remember that in America, in the United States, nearly 70% of households own their own homes, and a large majority of them are married. Now, I just want to give you a quick example of what happens to someone who does not grow up with this software that I'm describing, this marriage program. I describe this man in my book. His name is Ben, and I met him at America Works. Thank you, Peter and Lee. He was quite an interesting character. He, around 7 years ago, before I spoke to him, had a brief affair with a Dominican woman he had met casually. She needed a place to stay. He gave her a key. One thing led to another. She became pregnant. She had a baby. And Ben said to himself, my mother always said, once you make a baby, you raise a baby. And he also was a man who was filled with bitterness about his own fatherlessness. He stuck around. They last a little while, they broke up, they got back together, she became pregnant again, they broke up, she became pregnant again. Ben finds himself with three children, with a woman he doesn't love, who he never planned to have children with, and whom he does not see as a particularly good mother. Now, it should be evident that Ben was no thug. He was a very handsome, a very serious man who clearly had a sense of duty and responsibility. He struck me as quite bright, actually, though deeply troubled by the situation he found himself in. And he had a dim sense of the mission. He wanted to buy his children toys, he told me, because he had never had toys when he was a child. He wanted to take them to the boys' club and stuff like that. His wife, or rather his not wife, had no interest in any of that. Now, I don't think that you could possibly describe the problem here as Ben didn't marry this woman. I mean, had he married her, I don't think things would have changed that much. Ben's problem started way before he had his first child. He grew up without the program, without that middle-class script that I've been talking about. And then without those things, he drifted into an accidental family. And this is the situation I found with many of the single parents I interviewed. When you ask a 24-year-old low-income single mother whether she planned to get pregnant, what you'll frequently hear is kinda, sorta. When I asked a number of the men that I spoke with in America Works, where do you see yourself in 10 years? Where would you like to be in 10 years? Most of them looked at me blankly. They simply had never thought about it. What I'm suggesting is that without a program, without a script, without a way of looking towards the future, you get people who drift around without much clarity about how to organize their lives. It's remarkable in my mind that only about 8% of those who follow the script, that is, finish high school, marry, and then have children, are poor. But 79% of those who do not follow that script are poor. Now, what happened to create this marriage gap between low-income and or low-educated and higher-educated women, and to cause men like Ben to lose any inkling of a script that might have led him to a more stable life for his children, and who might have in turn, the children in turn might have moved into the middle class? In the 1960s, as you can see from the graphs I handed out earlier, Americans began a radical and a historically unique experiment. They decided that marriage and childbearing were really two entirely discrete phenomena. marriage was to be about adult happiness. In surveys, if you asked Americans at this time, do you stay together, should people stay together for the sake of the children, the numbers started to go way down until I think it's reached something like 30%. People still are saying the same kind of thing today. No, marriage is not about the children so much. Meanwhile, the question occurred to many other people, well, so why do you need to be married when you have children anyway? Now, some people conclude from this that Americans really are not very interested in marriage, and you know, marriage is dying and all of that stuff you read in a lot of articles these days. That's just not true. If you ask people in surveys, they will say a good marriage and family life are extremely important to them. The Census Bureau projects that 90% of women, and almost that many men, will marry eventually. Now, what our high out-of-wedlock birth rate means is not that people don't care about marriage. It's that they see marriage as simply a committed adult relationship and not primarily as an arrangement for rearing children. You may want to have kids, but that doesn't mean you want to marry the guy. In other words, Americans took one of the most fundamental messages of the marriage program, that children should be born and raised by their two parents, and threw it into the dustbin of history. Very few people questioned what was happening in the early decades of this revolution as the number of single-parent households began to rise in the charts I showed you earlier. And those who did, like the late Senator Moynihan in his infamous 1965 paper, The Negro Family, whose history I trace in Chapter 3 of Marriage and Caste. Those who did, like Senator Moynihan, learned that they were going to be put into a category that would mean they would never be invited to the right kinds of dinner parties. Now, even today, people are uneasy confronting the problem of the separation of marriage and childbearing with any honesty. They're willing to make education a national good and a route to a better life, but not marriage. My final point is this. This lack of clarity and cultural consensus about the decline of the American marriage program is a dangerous mistake. If you think of the last decades of rising divorce and illegitimacy as a kind of natural experiment, testing what happens when you unravel the institution of marriage, you now have the results. If you change the institution, specifically erasing the bond between marriage and child-rearing, you will weaken our country's ability to carry out its promise to fairness, equality, opportunity, and prosperity. Instead, we have separate and unequal families as far as the eye can see. Thank you. Now, I think we got plenty of time for questions. So, Bob Weisberg, or do you need to?
Yeah, just have to wait for the microphone.
Okay, Bob back there is.
It's on? If you were mysteriously appointed Supreme Leader of the United States, it could happen. Worse has happened.
Why not?
Why not? What legislative proposals might you make to improve the odds of people getting married before they have children, and how would you avoid the inevitable criticism that this would bring state meddling in private affairs, and this would be a cure worse than a disease?
Yeah. Well, the truth is, I don't really think there's that much the government can do. There are little things at the margins. I mean, we now have in Wade Horn's part of the HHS, I'm forgetting the name of it. It's the for children and families, or the Administration for Children and Families. He's trying to, of course, do just that, to introduce marriage into the conversation. You know, I tend to think that a lot of these ideas. Wade Horn is now introducing a lot of marriage programs. They're working with low-income couples to encourage them to marry, if they, you know, or at least to plant that idea in their heads. They're counseling people, counseling couples, and that sort of thing. And my feeling about it is that it's useful mostly as a way of introducing the M word into the conversation where it often isn't. A lot of low-income people you talk to, they just don't think it matters very much. So at least the government in that sense is able to bring the word back into fashion. But beyond that, I don't actually think government can do that much. I think there has to be a much more of a cultural consensus out there, and this has to come from religious organizations, which have, you know, not always been so good on this subject. It has to come from civil society. It has to come from all kinds of groups who can say, hey, this really matters. I mean, let me just give you an example of how hesitant people are on this. Sociologists, as I mentioned before, are pretty clear on this subject at this point. They know that kids do better if they grow up with their married parents. But they're kind of squeamish about talking about it too openly. And they're very, very uneasy with any kind of government programs that I can share. But they don't even want to get out there as public intellectuals and really talk up the problem. So I think that, you know, the government issue is, we're not even near there. You know, we need to have more of a cultural consensus on this. And as I mentioned earlier, we seem to be going in the opposite direction. The rates of out-of-wedlock births are going up, not down. So I would put the emphasis not on government, but on a more, you know, our elites in particular ought to be having this conversation. We got Naomi back there.
I was having an interesting conversation recently with a 16-year-old girl that I mentor, and she was telling me that several of the boys who have been courting her have been telling her they want to marry her. And they refer to her as wifey. I have no idea what that means. But she said to me, "Well, I have no interest in this because, you know, people I know, they get married and the husbands just cheat." And so I was wondering whether you've done any research on infidelity rates, or once sort of someone like who is in a Wade Horn kind of program gets married, whether they value the ideals of fidelity in the same way that maybe a middle-class couple would.
I don't know that we have results yet from those kinds of studies. None that I've seen. This is still in its early stages. But the infidelity issue is a big one, particularly in the inner city. There's an interesting book called The Sexual Organization of the City that divides. It comes out of Chicago, and the sociologists who did it divided the city into, I think, about four or five kind of subcultural groups. And when they looked at the low-income neighborhoods, they found just a tremendous amount of infidelity and violence. You know, I mean, one seems to lead to the other. And how to reintroduce that value into is a question that I don't know. I mean, first, we really do have to have, as I keep mentioning, we really do have to have this conversation that says, this is what the next generation needs, and then to talk about what's required within the marriage. It's interesting that your mentoree the boys are talking about marriage. I don't think they really mean it. Tell her to wait for a ring, whatever she does. But, these terms are used very loosely in inner city neighborhoods. Ben, the guy I spoke about earlier, would sometimes talk about the woman he had never married as his wife. So I would assume when they were talking about wanting her to be their wifey, I don't think that's what they meant. I think they meant something else, but yeah. We got a question. Oh, there. Yes.
Hi. If the straight community is marrying less, why is there this big drive among the homosexual communities to become married?
Yeah. I think that, you know, that there is a strong urge in this country for stable relationships and for permanence. We are such a mobile and disorganized society that I think marriage is more important in a way than it is in other Western societies. So, and I think gays have looked at that and said, we want that sense of permanence as well. Some. I think for others, frankly, that it is an attempt to gain dignity. You know, not so much that they actually want to marry, but that they want to be treated as equals. So that would be my answer to that question. Peter Flanagan here. Oh, sorry, Peter. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering whether the prevalence of unmarried celebrity couples with children or with serial adoptions, which seem to be given more publicity than their numbers permit, could cause this breakdown in a higher socioeconomic group of young people.
Yeah, well, it certainly isn't helping, is it? I wish we could shut these people up, but I don't know exactly how we could do it. Some kind of program for celebrities, you know, just know that they're different. Well, the truth is that highly educated women want to marry before they have their children. That, you know, we have seen this consistently ever since this marital breakdown that I've been describing happened. College-educated women know, on some level, I believe, that if they want their own children to be successful, they better have a husband. So they are actually, for the most part, waiting. Not always, but for the most part. Peter Flanagan has.
You started the discussion with observing that the sexual revolution took place in 1960. And if you look at your chart prior to 1960, you see that the gap did not exist, whether they were educated or uneducated, and one would guess, therefore, it didn't exist whether they were rich or they were poor. Now that genie is out of the bottle, and your friend Ben felt it easy, the discussion of infidelity is an example of that, of genie being out of the bottle. It won't be put back in the bottle. I don't think all the discussion in the world is going to change that in this society. And if it isn't put in the back in the bottle, then is there any realistic hope that we will be able to deal with this gap, this destructive gap?
No. Some days I share your pessimism, Peter, and I think there's actually a good argument for that kind of pessimism. On the other hand, I look at what happened, for instance, to teen pregnancy rates over the last 15 years. They've gone down phenomenally, right? Everybody said when we started to argue against teen pregnancy, oh, you'll never be able to get that genie back in the bottle. You know, kids are going to do what kids do and so on and so forth. Well, we've seen an extraordinary decline in teen pregnancy, something like, I think it's nearing 38% or something like that. So I think there is such a thing as cultural change on these issues. And I think Americans really are marriage hungry. That's why I said to you before, they seem to look at these permanent, you know, look for a more sense of permanence and something almost that transcends their everyday, you know, desires. And I still think it's possible to appeal to those higher aspirations, especially when it's the next generation involved. And, you know, my experience talking to a lot of low-income people is that they don't know. They simply don't know that their children would be better off if they were raised with their two parents. So if that information isn't even out there, how can we throw up our hands this easily? At the very least, we have to make sure that it's understood.
Here we go. Yes, as a follow-up question to the gay marriage, maybe too early to tell, but raising children in a gay marriage, do you think they'd have the dysfunctionality that you're addressing in your previous remarks?
It's too soon to tell. We just don't have very good data on the how the children growing up with gay parents are doing. However, I want to address this issue because it's obviously in the background of everything I've been saying. Now, my own feeling is that the debate about gay marriage has been framed in this way. It's framed about how you feel about homosexuals, you know, to a great extent. And successfully framed, I think, by a lot of advocates. I don't believe that's what this debate should be about. This debate should be about what is the meaning of marriage. And if my interpretation is correct, that is that the breakdown or the separation of childbearing and marriage is part of what, it, or is a large measure, what's causing this income gap that we're talking about, then I don't see how that, what that we can just easily say, oh, there ought to be gay marriage, because gay marriage, the problem with, many gays are raising children, as we know. Those children are the products of at least one parent who either cannot or will not raise that child. You know, it's already children who are not born to that couple. So if the problem is what I'm saying it is, then gay marriage presents us with a very difficult dilemma. How do we say to somebody like Ben, that my example from earlier, the young man with the three children, that children really are better off growing up with their own two parents when we're also saying, except when gays want to have kids in various ways. I don't see how those things can work. Now, just to follow through on this just a second, because it's such a complicated and very difficult question for many of us. I think that gay marriage depends on, the acceptance of gay marriage depends on not on believing that the biological children, or rather the connection between marriage and childbearing doesn't hold. So that you see, even somebody like Jonathan Rauch, who is the most impressive conservative arguing for gay marriage, he will say to you, that conversation is over. He said the relationship, he's written this in his book on gay marriage, the relationship between childbearing and child rearing and marriage, that argument is over, he said. Well, it shouldn't be over, is what I'm saying. I also noted in the Times magazine, I think it was this past weekend, they had an article, oh no, it was the weekend before, they had an article about two gay couples, a gay male and gay female couple that had children together, and they had this kind of communal setup. And when somebody asked, the reporter asked, well, what about the ambiguity of the relationship between, the child, their children, and these four parents? One of the people answered, well, look at all the step families out there. In other words, that's now the norm, all right, that we assume to be the basis from which we move into gay marriage. And that, I think, is a big problem. Until we get this issue sorted out, that children need to grow up with their biological parents, I think it's really wrong of us to be focusing on the gay marriage issue. Eamon, it's behind you.
Hi, this is sort of half a question, half a suggestion. I was wondering if you've looked at East Asian family values. So when I look at the culture war, one of the things that occurs to me is we've sort of seen this before. If you go back into like the second and the third century, this is the stuff that people are arguing about today is what pagans and the Christians argued about with pagans in Rome. It seems to be kind of a package deal. I don't think there's a lot of research, is why I'm asking, on Eastern Asian family values, where the sources are quite different. We know that Asian Americans, some of whom are Christian, like Presbyterians from South Korea, but are doing very well, I think better than people of European descent. And I don't see that a culture war has broken out in Japan or South Korea or Taiwan. I think it would be an interesting thing to throw into the debate I think you're getting very different behavioral patterns, and it'd be interesting to sort of understand what the sources of these things are.
Right. Well, it's very interesting to watch what happens when you have different ethnic groups moving into the United States and how their marriage patterns mesh or don't mesh with our own. The Asian seems to mesh quite quite well. I think that's in part because of their orientation towards education. You know, that makes it that makes them delay marriage. It makes them focus on the future in terms of education and so forth. Something not so encouraging is happening among Hispanics. Their marriage patterns are not meshing so well with our own, and we're seeing actually quite a big jump in the out-of-wedlock birth rate among Hispanics, more so than other groups. And it's something I think we really need to keep an eye on. Lisa Schifrin's over there.
What do you think the relationship between divorce and illegitimacy is? Does one legitimate the other, and does one come first?
I don't know that one comes first. I think that they are, now I'm thinking of it, there's a different answer. I think divorce is an old-fashioned American value. I mean, we have been a divorcing society for a very, very long time. What happened, though, in the 60s is that we went crazy. I mean, it wasn't, you know, we have always divorced more at a greater rate than other cultures, and mostly because we really are, we believe in freedom, you know, it was inconsistent to make divorce too difficult, although it was rare and considered a moral and difficulty. That changed, of course, after the 60s. So I would say the divorce issue is slightly different, but certainly, well, here's another connection, actually. It's kind of interesting. The low-income women, their divorce rates kept going up after 1980, even as the college-educated women stopped divorcing so much. And then it started to ease off, but what they started to do was not get married at all. All right? So, and a lot of people will say to you, that divorce is worse than not having a husband when you marry. So there's that connection as well.
So I just wanted to pursue that a little bit. Maggie Gallagher has written at length that she thinks a society where middle-class people divorce leads people to say, why should I bother? The same way infidelity creates the why should I bother, marriage isn't worth anything anyway. So, I mean, I think
you get into questions about the tipping point really here. You know, it just depends how common it is. You know, when divorce is very rare, it happens, but it's very rare. I don't think it poses the same kind of threat. But when it becomes so common that you begin to factor it in the way you're living, you know, I have to think about whether this marriage is going to last and prenups and all of that stuff, then I think it changes norms in terms of marriage. Yeah. How are we doing here? We have time for more, no? Two more questions. I've got Michael over here. I knew he'd have a question. He always does. He likes to bother
me. Finally, look to your right. My question quickly is, have you ever seen Desperate Housewives? Secondly,
every Sunday night. That's my husband. He's right over there.
And my second question is, what about interracial marriage? In terms of, it used to be upward mobility, you marry for upward mobility. That did not happen with respect to blacks and minorities because there was not much intermarriage.
But
my suggestion to you is that marriage, like the future, ain't what it used to be. People in their lifetimes, like they change jobs several times, change wives and husbands several times. They marry more than once. And there are different families from those marriages and family relationships and connections as a result. Right. I mean, who would have known, for example, that James McGreevy's marriage wasn't a successful marriage until he was outed?
Right.
So there are many factors we don't know because marriage itself is so private as an entity.
Well, you are right that marriage isn't what it used to be, and that's why we know so much about what the impact is on kids. because we have a lot of evidence at this point. So I don't see how you can just simply say, well, the world has changed and there's nothing we can do about it. When you look at these numbers and you look at this kind of caste system, which I'm projecting, it seems to me that you can't simply throw your hands up and say, well, people do what they're going to do. At the very least, we have to make it understood what the implications are of non-marriage are. I'm just starting to look into interracial marriage. The numbers are still actually, in terms of black-white, are still pretty small. They're bigger than they were, but still pretty small. And in terms of their upward mobility, I don't know. Don't know. Yeah, we have one more question here.
That in the New York City public school system, the percentage of children who come from single parents is 85%. Now, are you familiar with that at all?
I hadn't heard that number, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yes, that's what I have read, and I just wanted you to comment on it. And for example, would you have any idea what the breakdown would be, say, between minority and white children in the public school system?
I would assume it would vary by neighborhood. In general, we know that the black out of wedlock birth rate is 70%. It is higher in inner city communities. So, 80% and up. So that may be what you're hearing about. I don't know those numbers, though. I don't think anybody here would. Yeah, do you? No. It's 85%. Yeah. Oh, of course not. But you don't set out to create a child who's going to be adopted. Something's gone wrong, And of course, those children need a home. I mean, nobody. Of course. Yeah. Thank you, everybody.